And we're back for an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Vertel. I'm trying to fit All Too Well into an Alwyn pun, and it's not working out for me. So it's going to be a slow day here at Keep It.
Well, so Taylor Swift finally saw Stars at Noon, the Claire Denis film that Joel Alwyn's in. And that is why they broke up.
She's like, it's kaput now. Yeah. Just saw him last week when I rewatched The Favorite when we had Rachel Weisz here. But I have to say, in the 25,000 conversations I have had about Taylor Swift, most of them I unwittingly walked into, like a character in a murder mystery finding a trapdoor. This man has come up maybe twice. So it's interesting that people, that friends I have who are obsessed with Taylor Swift are now acting apocalyptic about a man I swear they have not brought up before.
You know, he's sort of like, if Dolly Parton got a divorce, right? We'd care.
Certainly.
But we've never heard of this husband.
I literally cannot name him. All I know is that Jane Fonda claims she has met him, and I know that Jane Fonda would lie on behalf of Dolly Parton. So I'm on this case.
So Taylor Swift and Joe Alwyn broke up. That's the big news this week. And steps from my apartment.
Sorry, that's the big news. Go ahead.
Let me do it like Wendy would do it. Taylor Swift broke up with her man this weekend. Clap if you care.
Oh, man, Taylor, I miss her now.
Taylor, you're single. You're hot. Go out there and get a different man or a woman, whatever you want.
Wow. Okay. She is a singular force in the culture. We do need her back.
Taylor stepped out for the first time since her breakup was announced, according to Grub Street, to Via Carota in the West Village to have some pasta.
All right.
But Grub Street also, in their Instagram post, was like, called it camp, that she went to Via Carota. And I'm like, I don't get it.
Yeah. Also, camp is just now the most over. It's like vibes. We've had our fill of this thing, and we gave it to all the wrong people, and now they think they know what it is. And I hate feeling like Susan Sontag having to explain it to everybody. So let's stop that.
I do feel at least a bit like you felt when you said that, you know, all of a sudden people were talking about Joe Alwyn. I get it. People online sort of went into their whole, we should give Taylor privacy mantra. You know, like that was some of the discourse that started to bubble up. And I was like, don't you people create Kennedy assassination theories for everything that this woman does? But
no.
All of a sudden, the breakup's off limits.
You've got Zodiac Killer numerology for everything she fucking does. And by the way, it's actually warranted because she loves putting shit like that in all of her liner notes and teasers and things like that. And she replaced some song in her set with Invisible String, which was supposed to be a clue that maybe she had broken up with him. Anyway, more of the Riddler nonsense from T-Swift.
Do you think we'll get a breakup album? Is she over that?
That's the other fucking thing. So this breakup happens, and then her fans are like, imagine the music we'll get. You mean she's going to write about rocky relationships and karma again? Wow, I can't wait for her to finally get to those subjects.
Can I say, though, that you almost predicted this?
I did?
Or at least manifested it. When we talked about the Eras Tour the other week, you were you missed Taylor's era of writing about like a new man, writing about something specific happening to her, but she's been with Joe forever in a boring, committed relationship. So we haven't gotten that Taylor.
I would like her to follow her bliss again. Yes.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, because the goofy stuff I think just works best. Like I think 22 is top tier Taylor Swift, which feels like now a far right thing to say. But.
I'm ready for her to go into her single era again, whatever that means.
Yeah.
She's also on tour. So it'll be a while before you get anything from her. Actually, that's not true. Knowing her, she probably has 60 things ready to go.
I do have to say she is maybe the most productive superstar of all time. And I say that like as a Madonna fan who her entire thing is marching against time. So
I say that as a Prince fan. He has 80 albums I've never even heard.
I was just talking about this the other day. I'm sorry. there's got to be some unemployed psycho out there who can break into this vault. I'm sorry, it can't be that hard. Prince isn't around anymore. The guards, like, you know, aren't on guard. You know what I'm saying?
Also, doesn't Taylor strike you as exactly the kind of person who has already written breakup songs about this breakup with Joe? She wrote them before she planned to break up with him.
It's like how Thank You Next came out seconds after Ariana Grande's breakup. It's like you couldn't, I absolutely know you, you know, laid down a couple versions of this track ahead of time. Like, on the off chance you broke up with serial dater Pete Davidson.
That seems so quaint now.
Yeah, right.
Thinking of Ariana and Pete, because he's completely someone else now.
Yeah,
and
who
she is
he
too.
With
she also took on the baton of marrying a man we've never heard of and stays out of the public eye.
No, right. He's like little, right? Which is a clever. If you want a man to stay out of the public eye, make him, you know,
she
Jiminy Cricket sized. Yeah, right.
Well, speaking of icons.
Yeah. We have done it again. Joe, you have done it again. Or what is it? Michelle, clown, you have done it again.
Yeah. The other one was, we did it, Joe.
Ah, yes. I'm conflating them all right now.
Yeah. That's actually how Taylor broke up with him. She said, we've done it, Joe.
I would love it if she spoke in memes to her friends. Seems fitting.
I hope she knows memes.
She must, right? There's no way this person is not extremely online.
I would love if Taylor Swift were, shading Olivia Rodrigo when Sour was playing, and she was like, Joe, she's singing off-key, on the record.
The idea
and then
that
Joe
she
was
would
like,
be somebody's
sometimes
Whitney.
You do too.
Yeah. Sort of your thing.
No, we have another icon in the building. This week, we have the one and only Toni Collette on Keep It this week.
I have to say, I love having guests where, you know, there are so many things they've done that you could do an entire interview about. But I was daunted hoping to get so many of these credits in, and I'm happy to say we did. Jesus. And she's such a fabulous interviewee, too.
Yeah. Also, claims that she's sick this week, but she was, I'd like to see her when she's not sick.
No, she popped right off. And also still wowed us with the fact that she literally is Australian. This is somebody with an Australian accent, and you never, ever hear it. I feel like that is psychologically wearing on a person.
Yeah, you know, meanwhile, Nicole Kidman.
She still can't undoing that accent. You know what I'm saying?
No, but Toni Collette is here to discuss her latest film, Mafia Mama, which is a title that I'm obsessed with.
Just exactly what it is. There's a mafia, there's a mama, okay?
There's so many ways that you could interpret this title, too. Like, is she the Mafia Mama? Or is someone telling her about the mafia? Mafia Mama.
Yeah, there is the ambiguous punctuation. You never know, right?
Yeah. So we've got Toni Collette, and then we've got Super Mario Brothers, the movie that saved Hollywood. Again, I feel like Hollywood is saved every other week.
Right. Also, the amount of money it made, it's unsettling. I mean, the movie is perfectly cute in certain ways. It didn't need to be Avatar level.
And then we'll get into the episode of Succession that everyone is talking about.
Speaking of Australian accents, I can't believe Sarah Snook did not come up during this interview, but she, I mean, that's one of the greatest performances I've seen on TV in the past year. So hopefully she has sprung ahead in the Emmy contenders list, even though it feels like Jennifer Coolidge is probably just going to take it again.
Yeah, I see that for her.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? These Australians might be trying to murder her too. All right, we'll be back with more Keep It. Wahoo!
Not a new accent and voice for you. I'm 5 years in. Lord, deliver me.
The Super Mario movie had a peachy opening weekend.
Mm.
and is now the highest grossing IMAX feature of all time. So what do we think? Let's get into it.
It got worse somehow. It's really, it's almost touching in a way. Yeah, do you know what this movie is like? You know when you turn on a Mario game and then you don't press start and then some video starts playing? That's what this movie is. You know, just here's all your favorite characters being super. You know what? For like a 92-minute movie, and by the way, that's the best thing about it. It's 92 minutes and not really a moment wasted. You get all the familiar characters. You get cameos from the minor Mario villains and baddies that you want to see. Like, oh, there's the guy that throws the hammer. There's, you know, Bat Koopaling, etc. But I don't, afterwards, it just feels like you played video games for a half hour. It's you're in, you're out, your kids screamed maybe, and that was that. And I frankly cannot believe Anya Taylor-Joy signed on to be just the most boring princess imaginable. She's good at her job. And by the way, she doesn't even have a job.
I mean, listen, Princess Peach has always been boring. Yeah. And I feel like there's no interiority here at all. Yeah, I'm sorry. I like, maybe there's fan theories, but I don't know. She's in a castle, y'all. And most of the time, she's kidnapped.
Right. And you have the toads that tell you, oh, she's in another castle. So you get the cute reference to the old game. I believe there's a moment when you see Princess float for a second, a reference to her kind of supernatural power she gets in Super Mario 2, which is still, I believe, one of the queerer things ever in a video game, that the lady in the pretty dress has some extreme ability that puts her, like, makes her a little bit better or more special than the other characters in the game. It's like how Chun-Li in Street Fighter is a little bit faster than all the others.
I feel like they really highlight it, you know, like girl power, giving her, you know, she was kung fuing.
Right. She could do like the obstacle course.
Yeah. Everybody was kung fu fighting in this movie. She was great at the obstacle course. She was great at speed racing. She was giving like Daphne in the Scooby-Doo movies, you know? Like when all of a sudden Sarah Michelle Gellar's Daphne could like do jujitsu.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm glad that there's a cinematic forebear to this important movie. Great.
Yeah. I mean, it's taking women who were, you know, initially presented as dumb heifers. And now they've got stuff to do.
From Hanna-Barbera to Hanna-Barbarians.
But I've always been a fan of Princess Peach iconography, even if she is, you know, kidnapped half the time.
Right. Something that actually is good in this movie. Jack Black as Bowser. So he, like, you know, I guess as tradition, wants to marry Princess Peach, and the reaction of all the minions in his life is very funny. They're all just like gross.
That, and I love how they make it funny and creepy. And the one scene where he's like proposing to Princess Peach, but he's acting it out like with a Koopa. Yeah, very goofy. I thought I had a great time. I was also stoned as hell. Yeah. So that helped.
The marriage thing is giving Jafar in the best possible way.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, definitely queer coded.
Yes, certainly.
Bowser's gay.
Also, Jack Black, the only person giving a like a Disney caliber voice performance. Like you're actually Oh, it couldn't be anybody else but him in that role. Whereas like Chris Pratt, nothing about that really spoke to me, nor Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah, do we think that this movie did so well because the conservatives went out to support Chris Pratt?
I always forget that, because he's like the king of a certain religion or something. Is he just normal Catholic, he and Catherine Schwarzenegger?
I think he's like super Catholic.
Okay.
That's why he was good for Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, you know? Yeah, right.
He's a super Catholic brother.
Yeah, okay. It makes sense. Somebody typed super into Google and he came up, and then they were like, he would belong in this movie about super things.
Don't you remember when he had that huge ass cross that was like in his yard for Easter one year?
I mean, that sounds great for him. I mean, I remember the Like a Prayer video. Is it similar? No? Okay.
Yeah, well, it wasn't burning.
Oh, you know? Then I don't remember it at all.
There's no black choir behind him.
Have you ever seen the 1993 Super Mario Brothers movie?
Of course I have.
Okay, because I watched it recently on, I'm going to say, the shadiest YouTube channel of all time. Like, Disney does, or whoever's in charge does not want you to see this. I had forgotten, one, I mean, it's obviously bad, but it's really a pastiche of all the kids' movies at that time. Like, there's a gritty New York environment a la Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And also, like that movie, everything is literally slimy. Why were we so obsessed with sliminess in the early 90s? I want to blame Nickelodeon for this and the entire GAC slime universe. But GAC just slime, everything
Ghostbusters.
With Ghostbusters. Yeah, Ghostbusters. Certainly. It's very Ghostbusters riffing. Also, so you have Bob Hoskins as Mario. He gets the least to fucking do in this movie. It's all about John Leguizamo, which I understand, sexy John Leguizamo. But also, these characters never once remind you of the video game. I can't get over that there's not, like, they don't bust open a block at any time. At the end of the movie, they eventually do go down a tube. But by the way, in Mario, you're only in the tube for a second. Then the game commences. Like, it's not really a game about sliding down a tube and ending up in a sewer. That takes milliseconds in the game.
I'm still thinking about sexy John Leguizamo.
He is. Am I wrong?
He is. He is. He's
my Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec. Yes. Also, another thing about that movie, like, the Lady Koopa person is played by Fiona Shaw, which is a fact that I believe is lost to time. And when you watch this woman on Fleabag or in any of her esteemed Broadway appearances, this is somebody who I believe was in Hedda Gabler before she was in Super Mario Brothers. Fiona Shaw, and I saw it with my own eyes, stabs Yoshi in the neck. What? And also, I mean, by the way,
you remember Fiona Shaw from True Blood, don't you?
Of course.
Yes, when she played that witch. I feel like that's the same kind of role where it's, you know what, the rent is due, let's have some fun.
Right. It's I will charitably compare it to like Judith Anderson and Rebecca. It's a little bit of a Mrs. Danvers role.
Yeah.
Which she should be playing thrilling, whatever. But God, yeah, it is a dreadful movie. Also, Samantha Mathis as Princess, they don't give her a thing to do. But she was somebody who was on the ascent at the time. Like, she would soon be in Little Women. But she was in a movie before that called Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater, which is now kind of lost to time. Really good early 90s movie. And I feel like this stopped her in her tracks.
I feel like Pump Up the Volume's lasting pop culture relevance is because of Buffy.
Mm.
In the prom episode, someone creates these like hell demons to go and kill the students at the prom, and he hypes them up by having them watch Pump Up the Volume.
Well, that's fascinating because it is. It's also Christian Slater in like five really good movies in a row around that time, and I feel like that's the one we don't talk about anymore. But my God, also
meanwhile, it'll be remade with like Noah Centineo in 2 weeks.
Dennis Hopper is also in the Super Mario Brothers movie, and that is one of the crazier Wikipedias you can go down. I don't know if you've read it recently. Did you know that he went on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno around that time and started talking about how he got into a fight with, I believe, Rip Torn, who was supposed to be an Easy Rider or something? And then Rip Torn successfully sued him for making up a story about how he attacked him. Imagine just going on Jay Leno and lying. All right.
Who's he think he is? Robert Pattinson?
Oh my, we haven't had a good lie from Robert Pattinson in a while.
I know.
I almost blew up my house with the microwave or whatever he said.
I did sit in front of him at the Beau Is Afraid New York premiere, though. He slipped in as soon as the lights went down in his baseball cap, his Carhartt jacket, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
He's always like he's on the run. He's in The Fugitive.
I was at a Beau Is Afraid screening the other day too, the LA premiere. And I always forget when you're at a situation like that, when the lights go down, pay attention to the shadowy people who sneak in at the last moment because they're important. I only caught a glimpse of Pedro Pascal. I didn't clock anybody else.
Caroline Polachek was there strutting down every A24 red carpet.
Do you know what I love about her? She's 38. And those girls, when they're like new and I haven't heard them before, they always are 21. Yeah. But in this case, she's already Carly Rae Jepsenified. So I appreciate that for her as I grip with my mortality.
She's been working.
Yeah, okay? Right. Did you grow up playing Super Mario at all? Is it relevant to you? Because I am encyclopedic about these games, about the original games, mm-hmm. The first Super Mario Brothers game up to the third, and then Super Mario World. We were a Super Nintendo family.
Yes, it was a Super Nintendo family. We got up to those. I was so excited for the Donkey Kong section, you know, when they were when Mario was fighting Donkey Kong. Because I was obsessed with the Donkey Kong games. Like, there was the Diddy Kong cameo. There was a Daisy Kong cameo. Donkey Kong Country 2 was my life. And I still write to the Donkey Kong Country 2 soundtrack.
Oh, my God. Just like Kurt Vonnegut. no, those games are fabulous. Mario Kart was the most played game in my house, but I loved that the personification in the movie of Cranky Kong. That was very cute. I also just love that he's styled like an old person, maybe on a sitcom in the early 90s, like the grandma from Family Matters.
Fred Armisen played Cranky Kong, and it took me a while to place him.
Oh, I definitely didn't. I assume this is one of those extremely high-budget movies. I'm sure every single role is a famous person.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Charlie Day was cute as Luigi. Luigi was not as hot as the internet was pretending that he looked, but you know, I was born to Seth Rogen's Donkey Kong. But you know, a lot of cute characters in here.
I had for like the past 30 years of my life, I've had some theme song in my head that I kind of couldn't place, and I looked it up. It's the Super Mario World cartoon theme where there's a sort of, I'll call it reggae-ish introduction to the show. But there are
that.
Two other, there's a Super Mario Brothers 3 show and then the Super Mario Super Show, which the opening credits has is cartoon and live action, but it looks like Cleveland Public Access Television. I have no idea how this got on the air for us all to watch.
That one I remember. I feel like the other Super Mario ones were around the time when I was still maybe watching cartoons as a kid, but I feel like they were more me waking up hungover in college and seeing Super Mario on TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting how video games, I feel like, really gave like gay kids opportunities to quote unquote express themselves. Like when you pick Princess in Super Mario Kart, something going through your head is like, this is a single mom who needs this to make this whole life work. Sorry, am I projecting? That's how I felt playing
this. A little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's why you cosplay as Sonya Blade every other Halloween.
By the way, nothing wrong with how those ladies dressed. That is very current. The Sarah Connor style. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like Sonya Blade just looks like Laura Dern in Jurassic Park most of the time. Just short shorts, tied up shirt. Hair back.
Yeah, always pulled back. Underrated icon in this category, Sarah Bryant from Virtua Fighter, which is a series that's now lost to time.
Yeah, I mean, I was a big fan of video games as a kid, and I feel like really has not translated to me being a video game adult.
No, I feel like the main customer for video games has changed entirely. Like, there still are things like fighting games around, but it's less a diversion and more a lifestyle now, you know?
Yeah, it is. And it's definitely, you know, like if you're playing like a full live action game, you know, like it's gone beyond Goldfinger or Doom, you know? Now it's like, I mean, think of just The Last of Us, the last big video game adaptation we were talking about on this show.
That is so immersive. GoldenEye, yes, right.
Yeah.
Say what?
Sorry, yeah, GoldenEye. That is so immersive.
Right.
You know, to like it I feel like it takes so much time. And I just want to shoot them up or, you know, beat a world.
Right. To me it's like playing Scrabble or something. It was lovely for a second and now I get to be mad at my mom.
what other character from like this Super Mario World do you want to see like get their own film now? Cuz clearly it's coming. It made a shit ton of money.
Well, I am, of course, obsessed with Bowser's Kids, which...
Yes, okay. When he was playing the piano, it said, like, Ludwig von Beethoven on it, and I remembered them fighting Ludwig von Beethoven in the game. His kids are insane.
Also, it's just amazing. So those characters were invented in the early 90s, and most of the kids are pop culture parodies that are now incredibly dated, with the exception of Iggy Koopa, who is, of course, modeled after Iggy Pop. But like Morton Downey Jr. is the inspiration for Morton Koopa Jr. And that is a trash talk show host from the 80s who's, you know, it's not a name like Jerry Springer or even Jenny Jones that people remember now. It was this rowdy, terrible show. They named Bowser's kids after celebrities who are either, I guess, just rockers, but they look weird. They picked weird looking celebrities to model these monstrous kids after. Like Wendy O. Koopa is modeled after Wendy O. Williams, not Wendy Williams, from the Plasmatics, who's like a punk icon. Roy Koopa is modeled after Roy Orbison. That's sort of the most conventional celebrity of the bunch. But Lemmy from Motorhead, another kind of Dead or reference. I'm not a metalhead. I don't know if that came across, but I'm not.
And yeah, like I said earlier, Ludwig von Koopa was always my favorite.
Well, he had the hair like Marcel from Top Chef. So yes. Instant icon.
Okay, yeah, I'd be interested in them. I'd be interested in them, but I also really want my Donkey Kong Country movie.
So. I think we're going to get that. They're too fun.
Yeah.
I absolutely know The Rock wants to do a voice on this. I absolutely know it.
And we need more Yoshi.
Yes. I just want to stick... I just want to talk about the 1993 Super Mario Brothers for a second, which is one of these movies where there's a real budget on it, but it also looks extremely cheap. Here's a reference I'm going to pull. If you've ever seen the movie Red Sonja with Brigitte Nielsen in the
80s... Absolutely.
Okay. Which is basically an off-brand Conan movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger is in it playing a character who's not named Conan because they didn't have the rights to it. In it, it's like it has a real budget. It has the budget of like Back to the Future, but the sets still look like they spent all their money at Joanne Fabrics. And in the Super Mario Brothers movie, you're kind of wondering where all the money is going. The slime and all this stuff feels like, you know, a lightly heightened Nickelodeon set. And then you see Yoshi in the CGI they've put together, and it looks like a pretty real dinosaur. Like, it's the Jurassic Park era, so they're obsessed with that effect at the time. And I think all of the money went to that.
Plus, dinosaurs are gay culture. So.
Yeah.
You know what one of my favorite Brigitte Nielsen roles is?
Go ahead.
Flavor of Love.
I knew it was going to be that.
I love her
other role? Yeah.
And I feel like it's lost to younger generations that this is Brigitte Nielsen, who is in that famous clip from it where, like, she's looking at a notepad as she laughs and she goes, from Flavor of Love.
Right, right.
And it's Brigitte Nielsen, Red Sonja herself.
We don't have any more 7 foot tall Danish celebrities anymore. And I think we're a lesser culture because of it.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, Gwendolyn Christie would be getting a lot more roles in Hollywood. She would have so many more roles in like the 80s.
Right. Definitely. When you could be extreme and sort of American Gladiator-esque and be a big star. Isn't it crazy that Arnold Schwarzenegger was the world's hugest movie star for a long time? Like, we don't really, I mean, I guess that's The Rock now, but we don't really have an industry of that as much anymore.
And now, where have all the gladiators gone? Huh? Paul Mescal, Barry Keoghan, beautiful man. Beautiful men. Two of my faves. But are these gladiators?
No. Right. That's the gladiators we're getting.
Yeah. Yeah. Bring back American gladiators, okay? Bring back America.
I could rank my favorite American gladiators, please.
I know you
could. It begins with ice on the ladies' side.
Someday we'll get to that.
Okay. That's like our Matt Damon on Kimmel bit. One day, Lewis, we'll get to talk about American gladiators.
All right, well, we're back. An Australian gladiator joins us.
Yes.
Toni Collette. Our guest today is one of the most iconic performers of this or any generation. You know her from United States of Tara, Hereditary, Little Miss Sunshine, Knives Out, so much more. From tormented and heartbreaking to aloof and hilarious, she truly does it all. And now you can catch her as an unwitting crime boss in Mafia Mama. She is talented and incredible. Please welcome to Keep It, Toni Collette.
Oh my God, you guys, thank you so much. Pleasure to talk to you.
I mean, thank you. You are a pleasure to watch on screen, truly in everything. And I love when you, you know, you switch genres so much, but I love when you do comedy. And in Mafia Mama, you are truly giving your best comedy. You know, you're working with Catherine Hardwicke again for a second time, I believe. So what was it like reuniting with Catherine for this film?
Well, I mean, it was amazing. I think she can truly do anything. This script was sent to me by Amanda Stairs, who's a producer on the movie. The story's her idea. And when it was written, she sent me the script kind of saying, you can do whatever you want with it. You can produce it with me. You can direct it. You can be in it, whatever you want. And at first I thought, yeah, I'll direct this because I'm starting to think about directing at the time. And and then I just thought, well, tonally, it's really very unusual. It is funny, but it's kind of poignant and there's action. And I was like, oh, I think this is too big for me to do. And then when I started thinking about other directors, Catherine was just it. I loved working with her on Miss You Already 10 years ago. Wow, 10 years ago, shit. and I feel like I got to work with, got to know her just on a different level on this film. I feel really lucky to have worked with her again because I feel like our friendship has deepened. But also I'm just so inspired by her because, as I say, I think she can do anything. She's the most unbelievably creative person and so authentic. There's nobody like her. The way she thinks, the way she sees things, the way she expresses herself, she's really exciting to work with. I find it totally inspirational and very, very, very collaborative.
I think of you as such a searing actress. Like the amount of scenes that come to mind where I'm like, oh, I have to like clutch something as I watch this scene.
God,
it's so bracing. That it feels crazy to me that you could also want to be like a comedic actress when you have that kind of capability. But when you were becoming an actor, was it always like, did you always envision yourself doing like wackier roles in addition to these, you know, movies that, you know, traumatize viewers like me?
I just never wanted to be pigeonholed or categorized. Or I think the beauty of being able to, first of all, I can't believe I actually have a career and that I get to do something that I love. But if you're artistic in any way, surely you should have the freedom to do anything. And I just think as an actor, if I were to repeat myself or play the same kinds of parts, I'd get bored and then I'd want to do something else. So it's literally just very selfish for me because then I can just keep myself on my toes. I get to kind of entertain myself with the types of stories that I tell. But also I have this weird and wonderful relationship with the work that comes to me. I find that no matter what the genre is, it somehow, there's always some correlation with my life, with some lesson that I have to learn thematically, you know? And I think that these jobs come to me, but they're not just jobs, they're life experiences, you know, and they're deep experiences for me. And I can't work on them if they're not. So it doesn't matter what kind of story it is, as long as there's some truth to it and something that just really speaks to me. And with Mafia, oh God, I love it so much. It's like properly wet your pants funny. When I read it, I just was like, oh my God, this is the best gift. It was so light, so like pure joy, you know? And it came to me during COVID and I was like, yeah, this is what I want. I want pure joy and I want to give pure joy. So making it was, I kind of knew it was going to be special, but it just even exceeded my expectations. It was one of the best experiences of my life.
Also, I just want to say that it really comes across in your filmography that you pick things specifically because they are not boring. Like even in like a traditional rom-com, somewhat traditional rom-com, like about a boy, like your role is a suicidal woman. Like you pick, like there's always like a strange, unexpected jolt to what you bring to any given movie. And I guess my question is, what are the kinds of things that actually do bore you that you're sort of sick of seeing in scripts? Because since I'm sure based on your versatility, you read almost everything.
Well, I mean, I don't read almost everything, but it's just when there's no change within a character. There just has, And sometimes, most of the time, to be honest, what I'm drawn to is an internal change, which is actually very difficult to externalize, to kind of show in terms of a story. But they're the things that I think move me the most when someone has some kind of life realization or epiphany, or, you know, comes to know themselves in a deeper way, or finds self-love, or just finds some self-respect, or, you know, opens in some way when there's a blossoming. That's what I love. It's a very basic thing. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I don't love is just when there's no emotional connection. If there's no emotional connection, if I can't connect with it, then the audience is not going to connect with me or the story, and there's no point doing it, because it's all about connection. Storytelling is all about connection. That's what I mean, my relationship to making films has changed as well. I think when I was younger, it was just an incredible outlet for me to emote, because I don't think I knew myself very well. And it was a chance to kind of knock on some doors that were closed within myself. And all of the characters that I played over the years have taught me so much about life and about myself. I'm so grateful for all of them, even the shitty experiences, which are very few. But, you know, the great ones, man, they live with you. I had to do this. I didn't quite know what it was. I did this interview recently, and it was almost like a retrospective going through a bunch of films. And I was blown away, because I still sat there. They kind of showed different clips from different films, and you feel every emotion still. And it's some of them are decades later. So I think once I'm connected to someone, it's like love. It doesn't go away. You know, it's always there, and you always feel it, and you always have that connection. So that's a long-winded answer. I can't even remember. I'm sorry.
I mean, to even get into, you know, figuring out an internal change in a character, are there roles you've had where you've sort of seen something exciting on the page, and then it becomes a bit more through, you know, obviously through like a collaboration with a director, and then you sort of change it from how it might have been in the script? Because, I mean, I feel like you have to be sort of a godsend to directors, because you just sort of take a role that we might see on page as just sort of like a character who's existing within the world, but maybe not going to be this standout, dazzling character that we're always going to be thinking about from the film. But then I think about you in films like Velvet Goldmine, where that character of Mandy, I just think that like no one else could have played that character so beautifully.
It's so funny that you use that as an example, because at the time, I think prior to that, I hadn't really been given an opportunity to play a character that felt so far from myself. Mm-hmm. And John Haynes, I wanted to do that film so badly. I remember I had an audition with him at the Groucho Club in London, and I've just put so much pressure on myself, and I just thought he was such a genius, and the script was so kaleidoscopically incredible. And I just love that period of glam rock music. And so I just had this, like, I kind of knew I was going to end up doing it. I had this experience where I was thinking about it while I was in Australia before I flew to London, and I looked up and I was like, is it going to happen? I saw like 7 shooting stars. I was like, okay, thanks for the confirmation. But I was so excited that he trusted me to play that role. But I really felt like I was, you know, I was having this opportunity where I could sit with the cool kids at the back of the bus. but when I read something, I can tell pretty much immediately whether I should do it or not, or whether it's mine. Like I can hear it, I can feel it, I can see it, and it is immediate. On a cold read, it comes to me very, very quickly. I never have to really reach very far to kind of, you know, make it real. And I think, I don't know, part of me thinks it's a laziness, but it isn't. It's just that I can connect with it. And if I don't, then I'm not going to do the best job, and they should hire someone who really does connect with it, because they're clearly going to elevate it or whatever. But when you get on set, what you can't determine is the energy. Like every job is different. Everyone brings their whole history and everything about them. And it's always a bunch of different energies thrown into the pot, and you can never tell how it's going to balance out or what's going to happen. And the most exciting moments are when it's kind of out of control. It suddenly becomes its own thing and takes on its own energy. And that's where a kind of it is a kind of magic. It's something takes off and no one has any control over it and everybody feels it. And they're like the best days at the office. It doesn't happen all the time, but when it does, it's just like, oh, that felt good.
It's interesting that you describe being so just game for, you know, whatever's put in front of you if you connect with the character. But are there any types of scenes you dread filming? Again, I think of so many scenes in your filmography, and I'm like, I cannot even imagine beginning to approach this material. It's so either crazy or sad or wild, you know, not of our universe. Is there any kind of scene you have dreaded filming in your filmography?
Dreaded filming. Well, it was only fear getting in the way, to be honest. It was only ever fear of exposure or failure or the most recent ones, I would say. I did a film, and really they were mostly about the accents. I had to do a very specific Dublin accent. It's an area called Talla. And when it's real and identifiable and people are from there and can see that you're not doing it correctly, it's so petrifying to me that people will kind of see that I can't do it or I've misrepresented them somehow, you know? So I did that film called Glassland in Ireland, which in the end, it's weird. In the end, I have all this fear, but I don't know how I somehow get there. I don't know how I get there. Maybe I have to feel the fear so I have some resistance, something to push against. I don't know. And then I did this other film, which very different tonally to Glassland. Glassland's quite dark. I play this alcoholic woman with this beautiful son who's trying to save her. And in Dream Horse, this Welsh film is about, it's a real story about this woman who, I don't know, she's just, I think, sick of her life and just kind of looking for meaning and purpose. And she decides she's going to breed a racehorse, and it's an expensive business. She gets everyone in the village, puts some money in, they save up, they breed this racehorse, and it goes on to become the biggest winner of all time. So it's a big deal to that country, the story of this horse. And just literally just doing the Welsh accent and playing a woman who was still very much alive was like, oh my God, this responsibility is too large. But, you know, also, it's the most collaborative of art forms. I work with so many incredible people, and especially on Dream Horse, I had the most incredible dialect coach, this woman called Nia Lynn, who became such a good friend. I really relied heavily on her. But in the past, emotional things have felt, you know, like, oh, I don't think I can do that. I remember when I was very young, I did a film called Lillian's Story, and how my character tried to commit suicide, and she wakes up on the beach, you know, with cuts on her body and has to walk. She's kind of lost her mind. She walks home naked through her town after being abused by her dad. And it was very heavy. And I just literally was on the phone while I was in makeup that morning, like, to my agent, I don't want to do it anymore. Can you please, you have to tell them I can't do it. I just can't do it. You have to get me out of it. She must have shat herself. Anyway, she talked me around, but I just did not want to do that. I just did not want to do that.
You also just put your finger on something that I've always been curious with about you, which is in almost everything I've seen you in, not discounting something like Muriel's Wedding, of course, you are doing an accent. So as in putting one on, you know, you played so many famous American characters at this point, where approaching a character, do you almost necessarily have to come, does the voice come first to you, what they're going to sound like? And does that inform the other decisions you make about the character?
I often do hear the voice, yeah. Like when I say I hear things clearly, I do. I hear it straight away. I hear exactly what they have to sound like and what they feel like. I can kind of feel how they move in an internal way, which sounds weird. Like with Mafia Mama, I had, for Kristen, I just had this idea, she just had to have this kind of high innocence, this high kind of vulnerability, this kind of girly, sweet quality to her voice. And I remember I was playing around with it in rehearsal when I got to Rome. And I remember I was so disappointed because Catherine was like, I don't know about that thing you're doing with your voice. I don't think, yeah, you know, we love you. We just want you to be you. And I was like, I'm going to take what she's saying and I'm going to stick it in my little pocket, but I'm just going to continue doing it. And in the end, I think it's in there. I think it's a combination of things, but I definitely kept those qualities. And you, And she does, you know, sometimes when I see little clips from the movie, it's definitely, yeah, it's not my way of speaking at all. And I just knew from the beginning that it had to be that. It's just, I don't know, it's just the way I work. I don't really have to like play and play and play to figure it out. It just kind of comes at me.
Which, by the way, brings up another issue. I am concerned that Australians are too good at American accents. You can't clock it any time anymore. I'm shocked. Because it's never the reverse. You know, like, I can think of Meryl in A Cry in the Dark. That's a great Australian accent. And then, can you name the second one? I would love to hear it.
Well, she's not American, but Kate Winslet does a very good one.
Oh, and what was that? The Dressmaker, maybe? Was that Australian?
She did The Dressmaker. She also did a film called Holy Smoke with Jane Campion.
Right, yes.
Yeah, she's very good at that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I think it's because maybe when we grew up, America's very self-sufficient and self kind of congratulatory in terms of its achievements. And we just didn't have a sense of self in Australia. We didn't watch much Australian TV. We watched all American TV and really backwards, kind of antiquated British TV, like Benny Hill. Like, can you believe that? So I just honestly, I was so saturated in the sound of America and what you guys sounded like that it's always been pretty easy. I remember when I first came to America, I did a little film called The Clock Watchers in like 1990.
Love that movie. And by the way, so do all gay men with taste. My God, we love that movie. Lisa Kudrow, Parker Posey, Alana Eubank. We love that movie.
Well, it was really fun to make. And I worked with a dialect coach literally for an hour. And the thing is, I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney. I don't come from a family who does anything like this. It's all just been following my heart and trying to figure it out as I go, putting one foot in front of the other. And I worked with this woman. I was like, this is interesting. I'm not going to work with her anymore. Because I just found it made me so self-conscious, like having to think about sound so acutely. Like, how can you possibly feel real to anyone if you're or be in the moment if you're thinking about that shit? So bless her. I mean, I'm sure it helped, but I tend to also just like with The Sixth Sense, I turned up in Philadelphia. I didn't have a real clear understanding of the accent, but I remember I would drive around with the Teamsters. I'd get them to take me to the, you know, the local market and, you know, here, there, and everywhere would take me to get the Philly cheesesteak, whatever. And I just soak it up. And that's how that's how I call it. Yeah.
I'm also really interested in how you prepare, I guess, for stage roles. I mean, if I'm talking about iconic things that Toni Collette has done, to me, I'm always going to be thinking about The Wild Party, you know? And
clip on the Rosie O'Donnell show. Yes. Fabulous.
Yes. You know, so like, and you have such a musical background too. I mean, you're in a band as well. And you've done so many projects, even like Velvet Goldmine, as I mentioned before, which has so many musical elements in it. Is music something that is very important to you? Is it something that helps you tap into a role easier? And then what's it like, you know, preparing to do music on stage, you know, on Broadway?
Okay. So yes, absolutely. Music is hugely important to me. I think it's incredibly evocative and it's so immediate in how it can kind of put you in an emotional space. I started doing musicals at school when I was 14. So I, you know, had dance classes and did musicals. And once I realized I could sing, then I had a few singing lessons and then I started in musicals as a teenager. And I, you know, that was my first experience of theater. Which led to a kind of more dramatic plays, which then led to film and some TV. So that was kind of the trajectory. But it started with music and this want and need to kind of sing, which I think is quite primal. It kind of frightens me a little bit because it comes from some place that there's a mystery that I don't understand. It comes from, you know, something deep, someplace deep. And so singing also, when you're scared and you're going on stage, you have to overcome it because it just immediately, any fear, any anxiety affects the larynx, right? So it suddenly is going to start closing things up if you become tense in any way. So there's really having to work through that. In terms of preparing for a character, I mean, I don't do it so much now. Sometimes I do, but I used to make playlists and I used to prepare, like I'd listen to a lot of music before certain scenes to get me in a different, you know, get me into a certain feeling. Well, I don't think I've done that in a long time, but I definitely make playlists just to, you know, create a little audio world that that is the world of the story or the film, whatever it is. It's so funny because I'm in New York right now and I was just walking through Times Square last night and I was having so many memories about working there and just thinking about that time and how you just don't know what opportunities are going to come your way in life. And it was kind of a challenging one, but it was also incredible. I loved working with George Wolfe. Can you believe I got to work with Eartha Kitt? I mean, bloody hell. And it was a new evolving piece. So working with Michael John Lacusa on the music and having that kind of evolve and change as we were rehearsing right up until we opened, it was very, very exciting. And it was a dream because I started in musicals to suddenly be, you know, on Broadway. Are you kidding me? This is the epitome of what this experience could be. It's the highest high. And just, you know, I did that. How old was I? I think it was in 2000, right? So it was,
yeah, 2000.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
And just having those memories and feeling so grateful and thinking about life and how everything changes and keeps growing and changing and opening. And you can never plan. You can have plans, but life has its own plan for you, I think.
Do you remember anything from that time where it's so interesting to me that there was also another Wild Party running off Broadway, the Litha version? Like, was there any like fun awareness of like the fact that like there are two Wild Parties going on in 2000, and it's like pre-social media too? So I feel like was there confusion amongst like people? Do you remember people being like, "Which one am I seeing? Did I see the wrong one, or did you even get a chance to see it?"
I didn't because I was so busy doing ours. I had actually, because I mean, I just love the story for itself and it would have been great just to have a comparison. But we were kind of inundated. I think there was a little bit of confusion and I think there was a little bit of like, wow, this is cool and weird. And I think there was a little bit of a competitive nature around it. I think some people were like, I prefer this one. Well, I prefer that one, you know, that did exist. But I don't know. I'm so happy with, well, it's weird to say the one I was involved with because it was just, well, I don't believe in coincidences. I really do believe things happen as they're meant to. And it was just the most incredible group of people. And it was very alive at the time. It just felt so alive, you know? It was just a moving beast, which was also representative of the time within that story. There was so much change in that time. So anyway, yeah, it was a great experience and a difficult challenge kind of. It's intense, man. I take my hat off. Honestly, at the time, I remember thinking it's like being... I don't know. It's like being a really intense sports person. Like you have to be so physically fit and you have to be so disciplined and there's so much work that goes into it. And thankfully you have, I think we had maybe 6 weeks rehearsal, and it was only a one act play, but musical, sorry. But it was so dense. It was really dense that 6 weeks doesn't even sound enough, to be honest. But I know now that's considered a luxury. I've done other plays. I mean, I haven't done a play for a while. The last one I did here was The Realistic Joneses, and that was, I think, 2013. And that was really, I remember them being told it's a 4 week rehearsal period. I was like, what? That's nothing. But you are never not ready. Whatever period of time you're given, it's like everyone knows the line is over there. We have to get to it. And you somehow get there. It's like, I don't know. It's like magic.
I have one final question and it's extremely reductive. I apologize, but I'm thinking of two specific acting obstacle courses you have done. And they are United States of Tara, where any given week, you had no idea what Toni Collette was going to throw at you, whether it was six characters or one brand new insane character who was going to like warp your brain, whatever. So a lot going on there. And then also Hereditary, which I'm aware is not a TV series, but the amount of tumult in a single film I don't think has been matched since and never will be matched. So I was wondering, which of these experiences was more demanding of you?
Oh, definitely Hereditary.
Really?
Yeah, United States of Tara. I know it, at the time everyone was asking me, oh, do you find it difficult moving between the characters? And I just never did. I just never did. I knew what it was, and it just flowed, and I took such joy in it. It was such a joyous experience. All of the cast, I love every single cast member. And I feel very close to it at the moment because only a few weeks ago, my son had foot surgery. He's about to turn 12, and he said he really wanted to watch it. I was like, oh, are you sure? And I didn't know what to do and everything. And it's really, it's intense. It's deep and it's dark and it's also fun, but it's full on, you know, especially for my son to watch his mother do all that. So it was really interesting to watch it again and to have grown and to be able to look at it, look back at it. And kind of understand my passion for it a bit more and understand just how important that story is and why we all gravitated towards it and loved it so much as an on-screen family. We all really did love it and love each other. And the crew, such an amazing feeling of connection and collaboration, and was, yeah, a really, really good one. I loved it. Hereditary. It was
exactly that noise. Yes. That shudder. Yes.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I got it when I was in Paris shooting the film I was talking about, shooting with Amanda, a French film called Madame. Mm-hmm. And I had said to my team, I guess I just realized that I, after doing Miss You Already, which was my first film with Catherine, that I, after years of telling people that I really was fine, I don't hold on to my characters. I don't take them home. I don't, you know, feel what they feel. Don't be ridiculous. But actually, I was doing exactly all that. And so I kind of declared that I didn't want to do anything heavy. I didn't want to challenge myself in that way. I just wanted to be light and joy and glee and have fun and make people laugh. So, you know, I did a couple of things. And then while I was shooting, you know, a couple of things of that nature. And then while I was shooting Madame in Paris, I got this call about this film, Hereditary. And they said, look, we understand what you're saying, but we think this is a really incredible piece and you should at least read it. And when I read it, it was like, oh, I'm fucked. I have to do it. There was no choice. It's very weird when it's like that, when it's like, I just know. It's just a knowing inside me that I have to do something. And I knew that it was going to take a lot. I knew that it was going to be a lot. I knew it was going to be heavy. But the great gift of it was it forced me as I was making it, because I knew going in what it was going to be and how challenging and how demanding it was going to be. I knew that I had to figure out a way. It's like when you're cooking, clean as you go in the kitchen. So that's what I did. I kind of, each day I had a way of, I started to figure out ways of cleansing it, shaking it off, getting rid of it, not carrying it. And it actually was a very smooth, satisfying kind of, I did have some fun on it because I was treating it, I was kind of considering myself more in the context of it, in the making of it. I think I was really happy. This might have something to do with me just coming to know myself as a person, you know, being more comfortable in my skin and knowing myself and more as a human, that I just had more respect for my own well-being. And I took care of myself during that shoot in a way that I never had before. And I continue to do that now, but that was the first job where I had, and I, maybe that's why it happened, because I really appreciate it because it forced me to have to figure out a way to balance out my experiences.
I really have to commend you for that role. I mean, that is obviously Ari Aster's feature film debut, but I mean, like, you did so fantastic in that film, and I feel like it sort of ushered in him doing like great roles for just great actresses that are so weird and creepy. I mean, obviously, you know, there was Midsommar. I just saw Beau Is Afraid recently at the New York premiere, and Parker Posey and like Patti LuPone in that film are just as scary and weird and intense as you are in Hereditary.
Parker, we were making The Staircase and Parker was telling me that she was working with Ari on that film. And I mean, we just looked at each other knowingly like, is it scary or is it just kind
it's
of...
It's actually not scary. Okay. It's more of a comedy. It's very Albert Brooks-ish, to be honest.
Oh my God, yeah. I can't see it. Yeah, I couldn't watch. When I got to Salt Lake City to start on Hereditary, he'd already written Midsommar, and the thing is, Ari's so freaking prepared, man. That guy is like, his mind is incredible. He's so incredible to work with. I don't know where he comes up with that stuff, but I mean, it's from him, right? And he mm-hmm. knows it meticulously, how he wants it to feel, how he wants it to look, how everything has to be, like, you know, very specific. And so we sat down at dinner one night and he told me the story of Midsommar and where it came from. And I just said to him, look, Ari, I think it's incredible. I'm just telling you, I'm never going to watch it. I just can't live with the trauma of those scary movies. I just can't do it. So I'm really happy to hear that this one, I'll watch this one because it's I'm sure it has moments that are challenging because he can't not do that. But
yes.
And I think that gives any film depth when you have all kinds of, you know, you can't have light without the dark in anything in life. You have to have darkness. They coexist. So I'll watch this one. It sounds like I can handle it.
Yeah. But speaking of that, I just want to say, and traumatizing scenes and The Staircase, I am good on watching you fall down the stairs. I do not need to see you fall down those stairs one more time. Oh yeah, my God. That was very tough.
I don't ever fall downstairs again in my life. I did it. Well, weirdly, they had prepared several wigs, which got cut too short. So we weren't able to do several takes. So a lot of the times I could only do one. So there was a lot of pressure on that one take to get it right. But yeah, having to die several different ways, it's a true story. It's just too gruesome. That poor woman. I mean, no matter what happened, it's a horrible way to die.
Yeah.
And with that,
thank you so much for being here. And
we can't end it like that. Can we?
All right.
We got to ask a question about ABBA or something. Does ABBA follow you around in some any meaningful way these days?
It actually, you know what? Dancing Queen comes on everywhere I go. It's just like this incredible thing. I'll walk into a place, any restaurant, any store, and I'm like, oh my God, they follow me everywhere. But I love it. I mean, Muriel's Wedding gave me a life I could never ever have anticipated or dreamed of it. And that song and that whole, God, that whole experience was just the best. So I do love it. It's a bittersweet, but very lovely kind of hug every time it comes on, every time I kind of merge with it. And it happens so often, it's weird.
I mean, does it feel like it's almost sort of like, I have to imagine, one, when you go places, people notice you in general because you're Toni Collette. But I'm like, if I were in the room with you and Dancing Queen was playing, I feel like I would turn to you and be like, all right.
Here's your theme song. Get on the dance floor. Yeah, a little bit. Oh, it's nice, though.
Well, if we'll remember you for anything, it'll be ABBA. And also, you always involved with the mafia. Connie and Carla, Mafia Mama.
Right.
I mean, I forgot about that in Connie and Carla. Yes,
yeah. You're Some Like It Hot.
Yeah, I am in reverse. I forgot. Yeah, you're totally right. Yeah. I mean, wow. It's really interesting. It was amazing being in Italy because it really exists, right? And at one point we contemplated shooting in Sicily and we were like, oh, it's too close. We'll actually have to kind of deal with them. You know, we'll have to pay all of the fees to all of the people that you have to pay fees to shoot in certain places. And then they'll come along and say, yeah, now you have to pay us, you know. Like, so many versions of all kinds of colored tape. But after we finished, Catherine Hardwick had a short film that was playing in, I think it was a women's film festival in Taormina, which is now obviously famous for White Lotus season 2. And they all sat down and they're at this beautiful hotel and they started the films. And then all the lights went off and it just got shut down. And they realized the mafia did not like it happening at that hotel. And they got all the VIPs and bussed them over to their hotel where they continued the rest of the film festival. And Kat was like, holy shit, I just finished a movie about the mafia and now I'm literally being herded through by them. How crazy is it?
Well, thank you so much for being here, Tony. It was really a pleasure.
Yeah, Jesus, what a fabulous interview. Thank you so much for it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Ciao.
Is this turning into a Succession recap show?
I'm about three seasons behind, so it better not. I did watch the last episode, though, because it was one of those things where if I do eventually watch the show, whatever the spoiler from this episode was, I knew if I saw it online, it would ruin the series for me. So I just thought I better see this episode just to watch it happen in real time.
That's fair. I love that you keep doing that with like each episode this season.
They keep reeling me. Actually, I can't think of another show that has done that. Like, I never even watched Game of Thrones in the last season when I hadn't caught up.
Oh, well, let me tell you this, and if you're listening, obviously spoilers for this episode of Succession, but I also feel like it's very hard to spoil Succession because it's not really about the fact that Logan Roy died this episode. I mean, it is, that's the plot of the episode, but like, it's not like it came out of nowhere. This is King Lear, obviously. Yes. This is a King Lear adaptation. Not as good as our last King Lear adaptation, as you know, Empire.
Or The Lion King, yes.
But the series starts with, you know, him like nearly dying, you know, and that is why, you know, it's called Succession. It's about who's going to be taking over the company. And it makes sense, thematic sense, story sense, that he dies in the final season.
So and now early we can enough, see that. Yes, yeah. Correct. Yeah.
So we can see it play out.
Though they still managed to make it shocking. Like, there was nothing in the preceding episode. Like, when they start the episode and he's just on the floor and they're doing, pumping his chest, you are aware it's over. There's no Shakespearean lead up to it.
Right. And I love how you see him at first, just with Carrie, like, you know, he's getting on the plane. And then we hear about it. It feels theatrical to have the death off stage.
Right, right. Look at you. Wow. Getting into your Tom Stoppard over here. All right. No, also, just it was so cleverly done in the episode how it was unclear how bad it was going to be, if he was going to die right then. And they believably, credibly stretched it out so that each family member got a dramatic moment to react to it, you know? Yeah. And they were, the kids were all apart from him, so they tried to talk to him on the phone. Each of them gets a moment. Shiv is away for a second, and so they finally get the phone to her. She finally gets a moment too. It really was, I've never seen guaranteed Emmy nominations set up like this before. Just one after another. Here's who we're putting forward. First Kieran Culkin.
It was a Emmy showcase, basically. Right. Everyone got a moment. Wow. I love that you just like tuned in to the end of this, because I've been obsessed with Succession since season one. And I think that this is just another notch in HBO's belt, you know, in that they have been the one network that I feel like has consistently been a part of like the TV conversation for years.
Right. I think other networks have sort of threatened to supersede them. Like, I remember a moment where I thought FX was on top of the world, you know.
Netflix had them shook for a minute because they were winning all the Emmys for drama. But good old HBO.
Carrie Bradshaw did it. I believe she is single-handedly responsible.
Not also, Tony.
No. I do think his kid is a good actor. I'm enjoying him.
Oh, he's quite good. I did not like the movie I saw him in, though. The Sopranos prequel. The Many Saints of Newark.
Right,
awful
right.
Awful movie.
But he good actor, good actor. Anyway, also just like, every actor, even the kind of ones not in the main orbit on the show, are all equally amazing. I have to say it's an actor's showcasey show, but I resist it since there's, you know, a third of the I resist it since, you know, it's a men's show. There's men everywhere. Even though I like them. Matthew McFadden is fabulous.
I feel like I only hear women and gays talking about this show. I mean, straight men obviously love it too, but I feel like it's part of our culture.
Do you know what is interesting, though, is they obviously just had their most watched show ever, and that still was just 2.5 million viewers. But within a certain sector of the internet, it feels like everybody has seen this show 25 times.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that also is what I was describing to someone about, say, like Z-Way being canceled, you know? And which is unfortunate. You know, shout out to Z-Way. I love her. But when you think about that show's ratings versus even like a Girls or Mad Men, which had similar ratings to that show, I feel like you have to tap into a kind of show that is going to create a sort of buzz industry about it, you know? And for a show like that, Z-Way show, for instance, where, you know, they were mostly just like clips online that people could see. But that show doesn't lend itself to podcasts about it, you know, or like people doing recaps of it every week, you know? And I feel like Succession and then like Last of Us, one of its biggest shows, you know, it's like that is, well, you're going to have sci-fi websites writing about it. You're going to have people doing recap podcasts. You're going to have people talking about it on Reddit, et cetera. And honestly, the same thing has happened with Succession. You know, people love talking about a prestige drama. And this one, I feel like, is so fun that people enjoy recapping it, podcasting about it, you know, making memes about it, et cetera.
No,
and I feel like that can keep a show afloat, because if you look back at the ratings, more people are aware of what Mad Men was as a show than actually watched it.
Right, right. I feel like the Z-Way show is a similar model to Billy on the Street, where it really is about these viral little clips. And that, and yet, I say this as somebody who used to write on that show, I don't know if I know anybody who literally tuned in to watch the full half hour of the show. And it was a half hour show, you know, on a couple of different networks. It's just not how you intuitively think to watch a show like that. Maybe I think you should leave as a good beacon for the future in terms of these are, you know, short, punchy sketches. It's presented in a punchy way. Like the episodes are what, like 16 minutes long or something. And then you get a handful of them and you move on.
I mean, I think that's basically, you know, sort of the late night model now too. Although people do tune in for a full episode of like Jimmy Kimmel.
They better. You know.
Keep Lewis employed, please. But no, people do still at least tune in for those types of shows, maybe because they're on network TV still and it's easier to just turn it on and watch the whole thing. But I do feel like, you know, like even like SNL, you know, I watch clips more than I watch an entire episode.
By the way, speaking of that, though, Molly Shannon was the host last weekend. That's how you get me to tune in. I did not realize this. There are only 7 former women cast members of SNL who have been asked back to host. And I can't believe it took this long for Molly Shannon to happen, but she brought back one of my favorite characters and lesser known characters of hers, who is Jeannie Darcy. She's an 80s stand up and very dressed the part. She has a kind of half mullet. She's wearing a very angular blue blazer. I believe she's wearing a bolo tie much of the time.
I remember that character.
Yes, and her tagline is, "Don't even get me started," except there's a real like volume affected quality to it. It's a really low-key character for her, actually, since most of her characters are, you know, zany and bounding all over the place.
I love that character, though, and I feel like that was some of the earliest, queer coding for like kids our age, because everyone watched SNL. Like straight kids watched it, closeted kids watched it, girls watched it.
Yeah.
But whatever you quoted from SNL sort of like told me if you were, you know, in a burgeoning Mattachine Society member.
Yes, right.
And I used to love saying like, "Don't even get me started."
All of her characters, licensed joyologist Helen Madden. I love it. I love it. I love it. And the Sally O'Malley. Wow. That was, by the way, the idea that if Molly Shannon were to play Sally O'Malley, she would be aged down now, since Sally O'Malley was 50 years old.
I'm 50. Yeah. maybe Sally O'Malley's aged.
That it's possible. I would like to see that progression. A24, let's get on it.
Although, isn't that so very, like, late 90s, that it was a character who's 50, who's like, look at me. The whole joke is, I can move.
Right. And I'm an old broad. Yeah.
I'm 50, and my body still works.
Right, yeah. I enjoy the idea of sex. Yeah. I definitely, if I were quoting somebody, and I did quote SNL all the time, because that was a stark difference from, I feel like The Simpsons, straight people quoted The Simpsons, you know what I'm saying? Whereas I got to quote Sherry O'Terry characters. That was my specific brand.
Gay people quoted Lisa from The Simpsons, okay?
Did we really?
We did. You didn't even watch it.
I know, right? As I've said, the show is a little
culture.
Too ugly for me. It's too ugly. Who likes yellow that much and dank yellow?
Okay, it's not like it was the Carol Burnett scribblings. Okay, you know, they weren't those cavemen drawings that The Simpsons used to look like in the 80s episodes. Who hasn't been invited back to SNL then?
I'm still waiting for Gilda Radner, and I think I will be. I'm going to be waiting a long time. But she was supposed to host, and they canceled the episode for. I think there was a writer's strike in the late 80s. But yeah, she didn't get to, and then she died soon thereafter. Tina Fey has obviously hosted a bunch of times. Amy Poehler's come back. Maya Rudolph has come back. But God, I guess who would I be waiting for? Sherry O'Terry is, I guess, who I'd be waiting for, because you know she could still do it. Every once in a while, Andy Cohen wheels her out to do a Barbara Walters character. And in fact, she had a very lovely tribute to her once she died. And I'm actually not a Barbara Walters stan. And I think Sherry's impression, which by the way, is not accurate at all. There's not one thing about her that reminds me of Barbara Walters. It's so, still so funny. And more effective than Gilda Radner's, which is at least playing with the way Barbara Walters speaks.
I mean, just like Tracy Morgan's Star Jones. Wasn't really Star Jones.
Oh my God. I am a lawyer. Yeah.
I was rewatching clips of that recently for some reason, but it was especially his allegedly.
Yeah.
I feel like that's how I learned the word allegedly.
In those sketches, the degree to which Debbie Matenopoulos would go down so hard, it really was brutal. That's something that is lacking from SNL now is like, obviously, they'll make fun of someone like Trump, obviously, and be quote unquote brutal. But really, picking a random celebrity who is basically unproblematic and just hammering them.
I mean, like that is what I even love from the comedies of the 2000s, right? You know, like movies and TV shows. Like you want something, and a random celebrity, just whoever the writers' room is thinking about at the time, will just catch strays.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I'm reminded of, I want to say in Pretty in Pink, Madonna comes up, who then is like a newish celebrity. And they're like, well, the music's not really deep. Like, well, Jesus Christ. Who's deep? 80s and deep is such an 80s, 90s word. It's like, he's not even deep.
But I feel like we got away from being able to do that because of the internet, right? I feel like Perez Hilton shifted that. We got to he was such a demon that we had to shift back to being nice to celebrities.
Oh, wow. Well, he should be in the slammer for that, because we had a good thing going for a long time.
Yeah, and you had to be nice to them too, because they would hop online and be like, well, that's mean. And it's like, why are you even watching this WB show?
Right.
You know, anyway, the WB used to do that all the time.
Oh my God. Oh, In Living Color. No show is meaner to celebrities than In Living Color. Please look up how they drag Crystal Waters. Oh my God. It's a parody of Gypsy Woman. She's homeless and she's just saying, I have no talent the entire time. So cruel.
Case in point, I was watching like part of Scary Movie 3 the other day. And
Criterion? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And there's a scene where Charlie Sheen is like, they're reenacting the others. And Charlie Sheen's in a room and like, you know, there's this like kid underneath the blanket holding the light. And then he rips it off and it's Michael Jackson.
Okay. It's both good and pathetic. That's what the 2000s were.
But you see what happens when you try to be mean to a celebrity now, you know. Selena Gomez says, hands off our kidneys.
Right. Oh, God. This is all to say that Succession is very good, by the way.
Yeah. Yes.
Please keep
it's
watching. Good. I know
also
I will.
It's good because it's mean, right?
Yes. Yes.
Everyone loves
Veep
this
great
show.
Was great because it's mean. Yes.
Everyone is always quoting it. These characters are cruel and they are like nasty to each other and it's funny.
Right.
It's funny.
All my favorite lines in TV history are someone being either like Jenna Maroney announcing a celebrity running from her past that's horrible, or like someone on Veep or a Veep like show being cruel to another person. Like, oh, your breath smells like a Haitian porta potty.
do not let Gen Z discover happy endings.
By the way, I had it with millennials on that fucking show. There's like 36 episodes, and you would think it went on for 55 seasons based on what people were saying about this. Like it was It's Always Sunny.
Which is probably in its 52nd season.
No, right. And also, I think they produce a new episode every day. It's like South Park.
Yeah. I had like a dream once that I would get caught up on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but I don't think it's ever going to happen.
It's like you would have to enter a monastery. I mean, how would you do it?
I watched it for at least 10 years. So I've seen the first 10 seasons.
Okay, so
it wouldn't
so
be that
you're
much
almost
for
a
me
ninth
to catch
of the way
on.
There or whatever. Yeah.
But yeah, I saw South Park was I saw South Park had a new episode. It popped up on my Apple TV the other day and I was absolutely floored that South Park is still on.
I'm sorry. If I remember when South Park premiered soon after Strangers with Candy premiered. Imagine if that show were still on. I mean, it's just unbelievable how long ago that is. I was in middle school when this happened.
Gay culture would be a lot different if Amy Sedaris had been on TV for several decades.
All right. That's the sliding doors reality we should inspect. I would be happy to explore that sometime.
All right. When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis, what's your Keep It this week?
This one's too easy. I mean, everybody would say Keep It to this, but here we are. The upcoming 12th season of FX's American Horror Story has a role designed for and now will be starring Kim Kardashian. I have bad news. I understand she is a popular television star. I understand she is a very followed Instagram person. Guys, that does not make her interesting. Do not put this woman on a screen in front of me and make her speak. I remember the SNL hosting. She did a fine job. It can end there. We love the novelty of it. Let's not bring the novelty into the serialized format. I will say about this season, it's the first American Horror Story season that will be written and showrun by a single writer, Haley Pfeiffer, which, great, because if one person is running it, maybe that means they will, you know, plan for episodes 4 through the end. Instead of just saying, we'll fill time with like Jessica Lange performing David Bowie. We have no idea. Whatever. Or Stevie Nicks running around a piano or whatever happened in that season.
Do not come for Coven.
Would you say the whole thing was good?
I don't remember.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You remember moments, you know? Mm-hmm. The last season that I really watched was like the Back to Coven season, the one like Apocalypse, where everybody was in it.
Also, I feel like the departure of Sarah Paulson marked my formal departure from having to care.
I did see tweets though from people who are like, well, I'm not watching this season. And I'm like, baby, if you think that Kim K is bringing down the quality of American Horror Story, I got something to tell you.
No, because they've tried everything. In fact, there should be just a season called American Horror Story. We tried everything.
I mean, she can't be worse than Adam Levine in Insane Asylum.
I completely forgot he was on it. And his tattoos that look like just the tattoos that are on the wall at the tattoo parlor. He's like, yeah. I'll just take all those. The one of California, I'll take that.
He's the Red Dragon.
Yes, right.
Yeah, I'm fine with Kim being in it. She was great in that Tyler Perry movie.
And she was which great. One was that? Yeah.
Temptation.
Oh, you do remember it. I thought you were bluffing. Yeah.
Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor.
No. I have to say, I am most thankful for Bravo celebrities in this way. I feel like they have rendered the television importance of the Kardashians a little moot. You know, because these people occupy the same sort of sphere and they feel very obligated to be interesting for real.
Mm-hmm. It's still always funny to me when people refer to Kim as a television personality, because I never think of her as that anymore. No. But I guess she does. They do technically have this TV show, which is the center of their universe.
Right. Well, I first and foremost think of her as an attorney. And I'm upset that you don't think of her and fellow attorney Amal Alamuddin as... but I love that period of time when people were insistent we didn't like care enough about Amal Alamuddin. I don't know anything about lawyers. Stop like pretending like she should have been on my radar and I should have been up to date on her cases.
Well, maybe you should be reading my Substack all about Amal.
And what happens there?
You know what? I have daily updates.
Oh, okay. Amal still with us.
It's like my version of Liza Outlives.
Yes, right. Which, by the way, we'll keep it to that.
I blocked it.
Also, it's not funny. And it is cruel to Liza Minnelli, the person it's allegedly toasting.
She doesn't like it.
No, and she herself has said, the joke is that I should be dead. Like, it's weird that I'm alive. And stop treating Liza Minnelli like she's baddie. Stop it. She's full of character. Sterile Cuckoo, yeah. 1969, underrated film. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it goes to, once again, heterosexual dating discourse, which always pops up online.
How do you keep seeing this? The algorithm is failing you.
This was going viral. And I feel like specifically in New York, because it's a very New York problem. But this woman who's like a student at Columbia shared a message that she got on Hinge. And once again, I have to preface this with, I loathe people who screenshot dating app conversations and put them online for content. I mean, have you tried getting a personality?
No. Did you know that you can't do that on Grindr anymore? You can't screenshot Grindr conversations anymore.
80% of gays just lost all their content.
No. It's like you're going for funny and coming up with mean every time. Almost every time.
And it's usually someone I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't want to match with you either, because so many people, it seems like they're just like waiting for this setup so that they can screenshot it and post it online. For
precisely, yes.
Anyways, this guy asked her out on Hinge. And her prompt is, the best way to ask me out is by opening with a time and place. Let's save the small talk for dinner. Okay. He responds, 7:30 drinks next Thursday at 456 in East Williamsburg. And she says, I'll bet $100 that bar is down the street from your apartment in Williamsburg, and you didn't give any consideration to the fact that I live on the west side of Manhattan. Yawn emoji. And he responds.
She sounds awesome.
He responds, you'd win $100 on the first part, but I took all that into consideration. I figured you probably don't come to East Williamsburg too often. Next Thursday is going to be gorgeous, and this bar has a nice outdoor section. And he puts his number in case you change your mind on me being inconsiderate.
Got it.
She screenshots it and writes, he really thought he ate that. F for effort in asking me to travel an hour to have a drink with you at a place 2 blocks from your home. Drinks is so he can spend less money, but it's nighttime so he can ask me back to his place after. And as if Manhattan doesn't have patios. First of all, you're doing entirely too much, girl. Two, I love a date that is drinks, because one, who wants to eat in front of a stranger that you've just met and you're locked into like a dinner for at least 2 hours?
I literally still think about, I went on a date once that was Thai food, and it's just a revolting feeling. We're very close to each other. You're watching my mouth move in ways it shouldn't right now.
Drinks, so easy. You get in, you get out. And baby, I'm just saying, it's so extra. And I also need to comment on the fact that she kept going on about how, like, it, you know, it's so expensive to take an Uber. She puts photos of the nice outdoor section, which doesn't look great, but it looks like unlike a place in East Williamsburg where the vibes could be fun on like a summer night, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's, I should travel an hour by train or $100 plus round trip for Uber for this. I'm going back to sleep. And someone found her TikTok, and she lives in like Morningside Heights, goes to like the Columbia, takes an Uber everywhere. There was like a TikTok about how like, I don't even know how much I spend on Ubers, taking an Uber to and from class, taking an Uber to Sephora, going back home from Sephora. I was like, girl, it's giving, get out of the car, take a walk.
Also, just somebody who is obsessed with getting the internet on their side when it's not somebody being either insulting or demeaning or just like,
Absolutely not.
The upshot of this? Like, we love you. You're right. You shouldn't have to go in an Uber on a date. What was the best possible scenario here for her? I don't know what it was.
The best possible scenario is like, either listen, you make fun of him and maybe he comes up with an alternative date if you really want to go out with him. But it seems like you're already resigned to, I just want to make content. So if you're already in the I want to make content mode, then you're not really even interested in dating anybody.
I'm a little surprised this is a Columbia student. Is that a legacy admission? What's going on there?
Maybe she goes to Columbia House University.
Columbia Night School.
Columbia House University, where they, you know, they just have those CDs and they send them out to people.
Right. God, we really had it good with the penny CDs. If you really wanted Rope in the Wind by Garth Brooks, you could get it for under a nickel.
The amount of CDs that I bulk ordered from Columbia House is like just how I filled in my CD collection. And then when that bill came, I never paid it. I'm sure I owe Columbia House thousands of dollars at this point.
You're going to be thrown in the Columbia House now. They have a slammer. That's where you're going to live.
What if someone came back from Columbia House right now and just started like charging people?
I would love it. Like they waited 30 years, like like a legal cicada emerging to get going.
But anyway, yeah, my main complaint is people who post dating app things for content. Because here's my thing. Unless someone's being crazy, like in a message, for the most part, you are two human beings who don't know each other and have different communication styles because we're humans, you know? Like, I know that the internet tricks everyone to believing that everyone's going to sound like them because of their echo chamber and get, like, your jokes immediately and not have weird tics about them, but you're two people who don't know each other trying to come to some sort of common ground. So, like, a lot of the times people will respond to something that, like, maybe isn't your vibe or how you'd respond to something, but that doesn't mean it's inherently funny or ridiculous enough to you for you to post online.
And also, this may sound too sympathetic to the other side, but routinely, people who aren't the exact vibe you expect that you get from your friends are, I feel like, the people you end up dating because there's actually something novel about them. You know what I mean?
Right. You know, so, and if you can't even get past like a, you know, a thing like that, like I would love to be called out and be like, you know, didn't you just pick a place like two blocks from your apartment? And you'd be like, you know what? You're right. Let me pick some other place in the middle or something. Or all you had to say was, how about you pick a place in the middle? You know, it's like, it's not like you know everything there is to know about this person from this place that they pick.
Right. And then you get to talk all about the middle and Maren Morris's contributions to pop culture, of which there are maybe three.
This is Jimmy Eat World Erasure.
That's true. Are there other the middles we're forgetting about? Patricia Heaton, right on primetime. They live in Indiana, I believe.
There's a mid-2000s Ricky Lake movie called The Middle.
I was just thinking about her and the theme song to that show and the phone number 1-800-GO-RICKY.
I loved the 90s era where Black people were so excited by someone doing something where they would just say go and then their name.
Yes. Oh, yes. Right. Oh,
go,
yeah.
Ricky.
Go, Ricky. Girl, et cetera.
Go, Ricky. Yeah. Like just chanting it. Like I think about that all the time.
Can I just say, for a white woman, Ricky Lake really convincingly said the words your man a lot.
She had swag.
Is that your man?
Okay. Ricky Lake had swag. I missed that show. Let's bring back the Ricky Lake era.
I think we tried a couple of times, and it turns out we didn't want it back, but I do love that show. Yeah
because I feel like it was swagless.
Yeah, right. Yes, you are correct. That is exactly what I was missing.
You need a Ricky, like, if it's a white woman, it better be a Ricky Lake. It better be a Lisa Stanfield, okay? Mm. Like, it had better be a white woman who could feasibly go to the Apollo Theater and get applause.
I saw you posted that Lisa Stansfield performance in All Around the World. Yes.
That really, Apollo Theater performance that she
really
does.
Shocking.
And that's what I mean. You know, the whole audience is going, go Lisa, go Lisa. They love her. And yeah. she's got, you know, her like blazer on, the slick backed hair that every sort of white woman with like swag in that era had, like almost like a Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah, all the kind of Marcel Wavy kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lisa's, and also Lisa Stansfield had a new album a couple years ago. Really good, by the way.
Yeah. I was listening to some of the rest of the album that single's from. Like, she had hits.
Yeah.
So if you put those on, that's some sexy music.
Been around the world in Ubers that are so expensive.
All right. Well, thank you to Toni Collette for joining us this week. That's our show. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram and Twitter, and subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. Plus, if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James, our producer is Chris Lord, and our associate producer is Malcolm Whitfield. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, that's me, and Louis Vertel. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Malconian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week. And as always, Keep It is filmed in front of a live studio audience.